Let's go.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Tapp, and this is the DNA of Purpose podcast, where we explore purpose as a part of who we already are. We showcase all inspiring stories of the most purpose-driven people on the planet with the intention of giving you the tools to step into the potential of who you were always born to be. After all, it's in your DNA. Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Future Crunch, and our mission is to foster intelligent, optimistic thinking about the future and to empower people to contribute to it. For those of you who have been following this podcast for quite some time, you would know that I have been on a mission since, well, day one really, to unpack purpose from every perspective possible. And 87 episodes in, I think it is fair to say that I've done exactly that. Nonetheless, there is one perspective that I have left uncharted until today, and one of the reasons for that is because only a handful of human beings have had the privilege of seeing themselves and the world from space, or more specifically, from Saturn. Today, I am feeling incredibly honoured to interview not only a globally renowned planetary scientist, but also an extraordinary human being who, through both trial and transformation, has paved the way for women all over the world to pursue careers in science and technology. She has worked alongside revolutionary scientists such as Carl Sagan, with whom she collaborated on the world-famous pale blue dot image of Earth taken in 1990. And her name is synonymous with the planet Saturn and the travels thereof, the Cassini spacecraft, from 2004 to 2017. In 2012, she was named one of the 25 most influential people in space by Time magazine, and this is only one of her many accolades. Her name is Carolyn Porco, and she's an American planetary scientist who is renowned for exploring the outer solar system, beginning with her imaging work on the Voyager missions to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune in the 1980s. She has also led the imaging science team on NASA's Cassini mission in orbit around Saturn. This was a monumental moment for women in science and one for women of influence, the kind of influence that ignites human progress. Carolyn was also the founder of the Day the Earth Smiled, a first-of-its-kind event held in 2013 during which the Cassini spacecraft slipped into Saturn's shadow and turned to image the planet, seven of its moons, its main rings, and, in the background, our home planet, Earth, while people all over the world celebrated. This image was not only a personal reprise of the original pale blue dot, which she dedicated to her colleague Sagan, which you can have a look at the video on the website, but one that enabled all of humanity to see ourselves through the vastness of space, feel connected to each other and all of life on Earth, and appreciate the significance of our own existence and the place to which we all belong. Now, in today's conversation, Carolyn and I traversed through so many layers of understanding the universe from a scientific perspective, but also understanding ourselves at a deeper level through the eyes of space. Carolyn is a scientist first and thus honours her research as sacred, yet at the same time, her insights and wisdom are so full of soul. And while it may seem obvious to think a woman who has spent a lifetime observing the wonder of space would be the first to advocate human inhabitants in space, the exact opposite is true. In her words, when it comes to Earth, there is no planet B. We must care for this wonderful home in which we all live. So without further delay, I am beyond privileged to introduce you to today's guest, the one and the only Carolyn Porco. Carolyn Polko, what a privilege to have you on the DNA of Purpose podcast. I'm feeling very lucky to have you here beaming in to the studio today. So thank you so much for giving me your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Fabulous. Well, let's get started. And as a starting point, I'm going to kick off with a question I have been asking all of my guests on this podcast. This podcast is built upon uncovering the ideas, the information, and the tools that we have available today to create a better future tomorrow. Many of the tools are gifts from the world of science, which is very much your world, of course. With that in mind, through that lens, is there any one idea, trend, or tool that you have stumbled across or that you have been thinking about that you believe will significantly influence the creation of a more optimistic future?
I certainly have, and that idea is knowledge. The unending revelations that have been brought about by our growing more and more knowledgeable about the workings of the natural world. Knowledge in the right hands begets understanding and perspective, and those together can form the basis of a vision of the best way forward. And with regard to human life, both individual and collective, there are two perspectives that scientific exploration has gifted us over the last, say, 50 or 100 years. One are the views that we have earned of the Earth and the other bodies in orbit around the sun that tell us just how isolated and precious and fragile and absolutely unique our home planet is. And the other is the perspective that has derived from painstaking research into the genomes of the animal world that has produced the genetic tree of life, showing how genetically all the organisms of the earth are related, and tells us that we have arisen from the organisms that went before us. Those genomic studies, as well as studies of animal behavior, I'm thinking of the pioneering work of Jane Goodall, for example, that reveal how much we have thought makes us human, actually we share with other life forms. The use of tools, the emotional behavior of animals in mourning their dead and so on, and animals that even have cultures. I mean, there's been a show here in the US showing called The Secrets of Whales, and it really shows how whales actually have cultures. They have modes of behavior and communication, and they invent songs and so on. And all this knowledge inevitably leads to the logical conclusion that we don't sit above other life forms. We are not the end result or the apogee of evolution, but instead all life forms on this planet are connected, and we can't survive and thrive without a healthy, prosperous biosphere, and furthermore, that we have a moral obligation to other creatures with whom we share the earth and protect their planet. If we could incorporate that motive, that, you know, overarching knowledge into the paths that we create for ourselves going into the future, I think we would have a far more optimistic future.
Yeah, look, I'm in a salute to the name of this podcast being the DNA of Purpose. I think there is firstly so much we can learn from DNA, but as you were suggesting here, there is so much we are yet to know that could really create create amazing outcomes for the future. That's a great
idea.
And that
guided by what we've seen from afar. I mean, like that recognition of how unique and isolated we are And well, anyway, I'll have more to say about that later.
Well, let's keep traversing through, but I want to jump back before we jump forwards. Carolyn, you graduated from Cardinal Spellman High School in the Bronx in 1970 before earning a Bachelor of Science degree from State University of New York at Stony Brook in 1974, and you received a PhD in 1983 from California Institute of Technology in Division of Geological and Planetary Sciences. You
Bravo.
I got through it, and that is that is an impressive list. You were also once quoted as saying these words: being a scientist and staring immensity and eternity in the face every day is as grand and inspiring as it gets. I have two questions here. In looking back at your journey, do you recall any key turning point or significant event that catalyzed your purpose to translate the wonder of the universe to the world via science and scientific communication?
Yes, in fact. It was during the Voyager-Uranus encounter, so this was 1985-86. Members of the press who were gathered at JPL often asked to speak to me, to interview me. And I ended up being one of the media darlings during the Voyager era. And it was they who told me that I should consider doing what Carl Sagan had done with Cosmos. Carl, you know, Cosmos came out in 1980. This was 5 years later. And they said that, I mean, they were the ones who told me I was good at scientific exposition for the public. And so it was a great encouragement and affirmation that I should continue. I never really entertained that up until that point. Mm. But, you know, here the experts were telling me I should continue. And so I just paid more attention to it. You know, I guess I spent more time thinking about how to do that even better.
Mm. So my second question is around, I guess, who you're celebrated as today. And that is, it's fair to say that you're really honoured and acknowledged as a pioneer in terms of women in science. When you look back, did you find it challenging overcoming traditional gender biases women scientists may have encountered as students and as working researchers? And how has that evolved over the course of your career?
Well, I guess I'd say yes and no. Mm. Those biases were certainly there in my student years, and much of the behavior that today's young women are railing against, I, of course, had directed at me. I mean, remember, we're talking 40 plus years ago, and there was no vocabulary then for even talking about such things. I don't think the term sexual harassment was, you know, was on the table. There were no committees that you could take grievances to. I mean, that was years to come. And so I just, you know, I put up with it and I got tough. I mean, really is what happened. And in the end, there was obviously nothing that seriously hindered me, or you wouldn't be talking to me now, right?
That's exactly right.
And it didn't start to become noticeable to me until I got to graduate school. I was among the first classes admitted to Caltech for graduate school that included women. I mean, really, they didn't start to admit women, I think, until 1970. And I think they first started to admit graduate women. And I think 1973, I was admitted in 74. So I was much more odd at Caltech as a female than I had been at any previous time in my education. So it was uncomfortable, is a way to put it. Almost all of the gendered behavior and comments that were directed towards me were, like I said, you know, I wish they weren't there, but they were basically all dismissible by either laughing it off or joking about it or ignoring it. You know, diversionary tactics we use to just pretend we didn't hear that, or
yeah,
you didn't really do that to me, you know. And I mean, I have to say, I would always register in the back of my mind, oh, God, that guy's a jerk, and I'll just avoid him in the future. And that's the way you do it. Oh, that's the way I did it. I think a lot of women in my generation and before me did it. You just bob and weave, and you just get on with it. I realized, looking backwards, that it did have a negative effect, I believe, on my self-image as a scientist and my confidence.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it took me decades to realize, you know, I must really be pretty good, or I wouldn't have gotten this far, you know? So I guess the synopsis here for my, you know, education was that I just persisted. I kept going. And I did have, you know, there was always some professor, maybe two professors that, you know, were like rooting for me, you know, saw that I had potential and rooted for me. So, you know, I just gravitated to those people who were encouraging and try to avoid those people who were just, you know, pains in the neck or jerks. However, the challenges got extreme when I became the imaging team leader on Cassini.
Yeah.
Then all hell broke loose, because my being named as the leader of the biggest, the most visible scientific experiment on the biggest planetary mission yet flown at that time.
Oh, I've got goosebumps, because what a moment for women in science. When I say you're a pioneer, like, that really captures it.
I guess so. But yeah. In other words, you know, I won the most choice position on the mission, and apparently that upset a lot of people.
Mm.
And I know that because from day one, and I literally mean it, from the very, very beginning, I became the target of amazingly vicious and extraordinarily disrespectful behavior. And I was like shell-shocked for like the first few years on Cassini. Like, I just, like, what's going on here? And you know, you always think, what am I doing wrong here? Did I say something wrong? Mm. You know.
You internalize it rather than think it's the environment.
Yes, yes.
And did you find it sort of added a layer of pressure with regards to your performance? That you felt like you had to be perfect in order to be able to deal with that?
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely, of course. Really, enormous pressure and anxiety and all that stuff. And really what it wasn't all sexism. It was really down to professional jealousy.
Mm.
Especially since by then, as I had said, I'd become a media darling from my time on Voyager, and that doesn't sit well with scientific colleagues, especially back then.
Mm.
I called that phenomenon the Carl Sagan syndrome, because Carl Sagan's colleagues, the people that he was coeval with, you wouldn't believe the nastiness that was directed to him. I was there sometimes in the room when, you know, he would be the object of ridicule, and
which is unbelievable to consider when you think of someone with the prominence of Carl Sagan these days.
Well, even today, people of that who do that get a lot of crap directed at them.
Yeah.
But in Carl Sagan, back then, it was really bad. It was really bad. So while I was undergoing this, I'd always calibrate. I'd always go back, I think of Carl, and I thought, okay, now, you know, this is happening to me, but I eventually learned not to take it personally and to realize it had nothing to do with me, especially since it began before I'd even said anything, before my team and I ever took a stance that the other teams and the other scientists would find objectionable. It had nothing to do with anything. It really started right at the beginning, almost before I opened my mouth. So that's it. It was really, it was the nature of the position, you know, being the head of the imaging team. First of all, the imaging team, at least on all the missions prior to that, Voyager, Galileo, the outer solar system ones, probably also for the inner solar system ones, although I know a lot less about them, the imaging team, and especially the leader of the imaging team, are absolutely hated because we are the ones that get all the attention from the press, and other scientists hate it. Now, add to that the provocation, the added provocation that I was a female, and it just got really ugly. And I have to say this, just to be honest, it's not probably popular to say.
Oh, I appreciate the honesty.
It came from scientific colleagues, both male and female.
Mm.
The males were generally more directly confrontational about it, but the women were what you would expect, more backstabbing, more sabotaging. So, and that threw me for a loop. I feel so naive looking back at it. Like, what was wrong with you? Of course you should have expected that, but I didn't. I think it had a lot to do with the fact that I came up through the rank. I grew up with only brothers.
Yeah.
So I didn't know, deep inside, I didn't have it built into me, this internal competition that sisters have, and maybe they get to know how to navigate that. I had not a clue. So I just got broadsided every time some woman did some really, where did that come from? I was very broadsided by it. But anyway, so it was just a general disregard for the woman leader. And it came from everywhere. You asked me, did it evolve over the course of my career?
And that was my next question is, you must be proud, I guess, to see the progress over the last 50 years at some level.
Well, okay, so yes, there are many more females in the physical sciences than when I started out. It seems to me the women regard each other better than happened in my generation. I don't know if that's technically true. Someone would have to analyze it, but it certainly seems better than I had it. But did it evolve within Cassini? Only somewhat. Because once relationships are set, they don't change much.
Yeah.
And even 27 years later, they didn't change much. So, that was just the nature of the game. So, it was not pleasant. It was a very, it was hard. But again, I persisted,
And thank God you did persist, because I dare say that you are the reason that there would be young girls today who are excited about stepping into the world of science. So I think the world is glad that you persisted.
Well, I'm glad you said that because, I was very busy, very, very busy for 27 years. Mm. And I got a lot of people writing to me, members of the public writing to me. I never got to really respond to most of it. I feel terribly guilty about that. But I realize now, because I'm, still getting that kind of communication from the public, and I love it now. It really almost brings tears to my eyes when there's young women in science and they say, you were the reason why I got in. It's like, wow, really? That's so nice. It's really nice to hear.
Oh. So I'm glad. I can feel the warmth around that. That's beautiful and a testament to you and your career. So let's have a bit more of a chat about that impressive career. In 1983, you were officially drafted onto the Voyager imaging team, which we've just heard a little bit about, to prepare for the flybys of Uranus and Neptune. But you did your thesis using data that had been returned from Voyager's flyby of Saturn. This was the beginning of a lifelong connection to Saturn. Why has your connection to this planet been so profound?
Well, it's where my first discoveries were.
Mm.
It's almost like your first kiss, those first thrills, that incredible feeling of intimate connection with nature and with the universe that you feel when you've uncovered something, some mystery, especially when it's something that at the moment you discover it, you're aware of it and nobody else knows. I can't tell you what a high that is. Really, it's absolutely the greatest high. There's nothing that could beat it. And Saturn offered so much. It was so rich with all this phenomena and that we hadn't seen before. And it just was To me, Voyager was the peak. It was really the best mission, the best experience, this tremendous feeling of, you know, adventure, you know, like an odyssey, really like Homer's Odyssey. That's what it felt like. I have to say, though, I also have a deep love for Neptune. Mm-hmm. Neptune was that last planet at the edge of the solar system. It had the blue and the white of Earth. So it like pulled on your heartstrings, and it was the last planet that Voyager visited. So it was the end of this fantastic mission and experience. And it was when all we scientists said farewell to each other, farewell to the engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and we went our separate ways. It was like, you know, I don't know, Christopher Columbus's crew, you know, coming back into port, and that's it. They say goodbye to each other, and it's all over. So anyway, incredible feelings of connection and also immense gratitude that I got to be a part of that.
So, Carolyn, at Future Crunch, who are the sponsors of this podcast, and in my own work in decoding the nature of purpose, I have quoted the great Carl Sagan many times. I know that you had the pleasure of working with him in planning Voyager's celebrated pale blue dot picture of the Earth. This was the first ever portrait of the solar system taken by Voyager 1. Can you share with me any significant memories or experiences from this time? And of course, what was it like working with the great Carl Sagan?
Everybody loves Carl Sagan.
Everybody.
And it's wonderful that they do, because personally, he was a dear. He was kind. He was considerate. He was gentlemanly, gracious. He was everything that you see on TV or read about. I mean, actually, he was very old-worldly, gentlemanly. Sometimes I thought when we greeted, we said hello, or we encountered each other, that he was going to take my hand and kiss it kind of thing. He was that kind of old-fashioned. He was really a champion for the underdog. Mm. He told me that because he, as a Jewish person, and from his generation, you know, felt like he was an underdog. And so he had great empathy for anybody who was an underdog. And he certainly saw me as one, being a very rare female in this, endeavor that was overrun by males. And he just was fabulous. He's, you know, when he was present, when people were being maybe, you know, like I told you, there were times people were kind of jerky. Mm. People were being jerky to me in some way. He'd come to my defense, or he'd come and shore me up when he thought I needed it. Or it was amazing. It felt so nice to feel that, you know, I had him protecting me, that he had my back. Professionally, he set a very high standard. He was disciplined in his scientific research and his approach to science. He was rational. He revered the scientific process as the guiding light that it is, and he, you know, abided by it. I mean, here's a guy who was desperate almost. I mean, not desperate really, but so eager to know if there was life elsewhere. But he would be the first to say, you know, the results of the Viking experiment didn't show conclusively that there was any life at all. You know, it's not a lot of what you see today, which is regretful, I think, that a lot of scientists, because of all the attention that's paid to science, which is good, but there's always a downside, and all the media attention that's paid to science, a lot of scientists play for the press, and they overstate either the confidence of their results or the significance of their results. Carl was not one to do that. He really just followed the scientific method, follow the evidence. You know, if the evidence is not there, if you can't prove it, it's not something you pursue anymore. I mean, you know, it's not something you talk about anymore. So he was very disciplined that way. And he was the person who always could bring calm to a room if, you know, emotions had gotten high and, you know, had erupted. He was the guy who could just like, you know, okay, let's everybody calm down and, you know, have a good outcome in a meeting. And he was a great, I would say he was a great humanitarian. You just have to, you know, go see the first Cosmos or read his book, Contact, to know that. He was a very rare individual. I feel so grateful that I got to know him and got to work with him. And though, like I was saying, he was the target of untold indignities and ridicule by colleagues for being, in their view, a grandstander, he never retaliated. He always remained gracious and just took it on the chin and withstood it all. I think often of the fact that Carl died before Cassini got to Saturn, which makes me so sad. He never got to see the surface of Titan, a moon that he had studied. He never got to see the vast dune fields of organic materials. He was the one who would say, you know, there's probably organic matter falling like manna from heaven on the surface of Titan. And there it was in the form of these dune fields. He never got to see that. He never saw the liquid hydrocarbons on the surface. He never got to see our methane rain. And he missed all our discoveries at Enceladus. Just makes me so sad. I was so looking forward to showing him our images, and I never got to do that.
Well, I hope he saw them through your eyes. And he certainly has left such a profound legacy. I think for me, I mean, I'm obviously not a scientist, but the reason he has moved me so much is because of the intricate, like the magic he has been able to capture about the deeply human parts of ourself through the lens of science.
Absolutely. That's what Cosmos was all about. Mm. He was the one who just made it so clear that, you know, science was a transforming feature of human culture.
Yeah.
And that's so true.
So I just want to come back into this question a little bit to talk to you about the pale blue dot picture. I mentioned to a few of my colleagues that I was interviewing you, and everybody remembers this and knows this. Do you have any significant memories or moments that you're able to share from that experience?
Well, I could just tell you how I came to be involved with it. When I was added to the officially, well, okay, let me back up. I was working with the Voyager imaging team at Saturn Encounter, but as a student, I was associated with one of the team members. So I was a student and I hadn't participated in the planning in any way, but there was so much that was found by Voyager at Saturn that they needed other people, you know, other hands to you know, work with the data and figure out what was going on. So I got to work on two very good topics that became the subject of my thesis. And then I got added to the imaging team in October of 1983. And as soon as I was added to the team, well, about maybe 6 months later, I started inquiring about taking a picture of Earth and the other planets from Voyager. It was just this idea that I thought would be cool to see, you know, what the solar system and what the Earth look like from, you know, Voyager's perspective. And I knew nothing about Carl Sagan's effort. I spoke to the Voyager imaging team leader. I spoke to the project scientist. I believe I spoke to other people at JPL. And I got nowhere. Now, mind you, I was a new team member, and some of these people I spoke to don't even remember that I spoke to them, because I'm sure I made no impression whatsoever. So I remember Ed Stone telling me that, you know, this kind of thing would never fly. They would never take a picture of the Earth unless I could find some science in it. Mm. Remember, Ed Stone was the project scientist. He was the one who was there to protect, extract the most science out of the mission. So he basically said, if you could find science in doing this, maybe we would do it. But I couldn't at the time think of any. So I ended up proposing something else that to do with Voyager that was out of the ordinary. and just went my merry way. And then it was a few years later that I learned that Carl had actually been actively trying to do the very same thing. Mm-hmm. And he had started 2 years before me. He had collected a handful of JPL people to help him. And he was getting the same pushback. You know, the project didn't want to do it. The engineers didn't want to do it. It actually would be, I mean, it's, you know, amazing now to think about this, but they were very nervous about taking the spacecraft off Earth line. In Voyager, the spacecraft was always in communication with the Earth. And so in order to take this picture, you'd have to drop the communication link, turn the spacecraft a little bit to take the picture. And they didn't want to do that. And also there were funding issues and so on. So anyway, a few years go by, 1988, I learned that Carl was trying to do the same thing. And I just went up to him one day and said, Carl, I tried to do this too. And I couldn't get it done. And so all he said to me, I remember this distinctly, all he said to me was, well, then help me. Because he was desperate. He really wanted to get this done. And he said that I could be useful in calculating exposure times because they didn't have anybody to calculate the exposure times. And so that's what I went off and did. And that was my contribution to it. And then eventually the picture got taken and he and I for a time were involved, there's a long story here, but involved in writing a paper or about to write a paper along with the people at JPL about how the whole thing came to be and so on. And our version of the paper never got done because Carl soon thereafter took sick and eventually passed away. But anyway, it was the same Carl. It was just, you know, just very reasoned, very disciplined. Any time I had any interaction with Carl, it was always a highlight.
Yeah, what beautiful memories for you and you created some amazing memories for the world as well. It's certainly had a significant effect on humanity, that image.
But the pale blue dot has become a meme, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It just really, you say that word and people immediately know that, you know, we are the stewards of this planet and we have to act responsibly, right? Isn't that what it says?
Oh, on so many levels, it connects us so deeply with our humanity. And over the course of the rest of the podcast today, I'm really excited to lean into how you've integrated your perception through these experiences of what it means to fully honour the earth in which we live. And I'm excited to go into that with you in a bit more detail shortly. Carolyn, from here, in terms of your career journey, I understand that you were picked to be the leader of the imaging science team. Again, we've mentioned that before, for the Cassini-Huygens mission, a mission that placed a spacecraft in orbit around Saturn. You were the director of the Cassini Imaging Central Laboratory. This was where Cassini images were processed and shown to the public. You were also the leader of the scientific investigation conducted with the imaging science experiment. In 2007, you did a TED Talk about Saturn, and in the talk you spoke about two of the many moons that Saturn has, Titan and Enceladus, and I might need you to correct my pronunciation on that one. But
it's Enceladus.
Enceladus. Thank you. I had a feeling I might have said that the wrong way. Now, until Cassini had arrived there, Titan was the largest single expanse of unexplored terrain that remained in the solar system. From what I understand, its atmosphere was the most similar to Earth. With all of that in mind, what did Cassini learn from Titan and Enceladus that has assisted us in better understanding Saturn and also the Earth?
Well, what can I say? At Titan, what we basically did was we finally saw the surface. And of course, other instruments and the imaging experiment too investigated to some degree the atmosphere of Titan. So it was like the reconnaissance of another world. We had not seen the surface of Titan with Voyager. So like, that's what that statement means. It was the largest single expanse of unexplored terrain that we had remaining in the solar system. It was like another world, the final world in, you know, among the planetary portion anyway, that needed to be, well, the largest one that needed to be investigated. So that was it. We finally saw the surface. We came to understand its surface environment. And it turns out Titan is as geographically complex as the Earth, with channels cut by flowing liquid hydrocarbons and bodies of liquid hydrocarbons, seas and lakes, and with shorelines that look like Maine and dune fields, like I already said, of organic matter that are vast and they gird the entire equatorial region. It's just, I mean, and I could go on and on. It's just a fascinating, absolutely fascinating place. It was the slow reveal of Titan over the Cassini mission was like just the greatest, you know, what am I trying to say here? Suspense. Yeah, that's the word, the greatest suspense. And then, of course, Enceladus was just absolutely incredible. It, you know, I put a statement in a paper that our team wrote. All the teams wrote these kinds of papers where before we got into orbit, we laid out what our instruments' capabilities were and the science that we hoped to do. This was like, okay, folks, we're almost there. This is what we expect we're going to be able to do. We expected that there was something going on with Enceladus. So it's not, what we found there was not a total surprise, but I was confident enough, or maybe cocky enough, however you want to call it, to say that it was likely Enceladus was going to turn out to be the Europa of the Saturn system. Do you know what I'm referring to there?
No, I'd love you to explain further for me and our listeners.
Okay, so Europa is the moon of Jupiter that the Galileo mission found to have a region on its surface that looked like ice flows that had been frozen together. Wow. So think of ice flows in the, you know, the Arctic, the North Pole of the Earth.
Yep.
Think of them as being just all abutting one another and like freezing in place. That's what this Connemara chaos region of Europa looked like. And other results of other instruments indicated that there was an ocean of water under the ice. So that was very, very exciting. People get, you know, very excited about it, the idea that maybe there's life there and so on. And I anyway, but I think my other team members did too, suspected that Enceladus could end up being like
if
that.
If it was possible, it was there, yeah.
And we were right. We found just a, you know, geysering activity at the South Pole. We found excess thermal emission coming from the South Pole that, you know, basically would be like, you know, Antarctica being hotter than the equator.
Yeah.
That was bizarre at first. And Cassini during the mission got the opportunity to fly through the plume. And so there were instruments that could grab the material and measure it. And we found that there was water vapor and organic materials. There was even evidence for hydrothermal activity. It was really just phenomenal. It ended up being checking all the boxes for a body that had a habitable zone. At least what we construed to be a subterranean, a subsurface habitable zone. So it was as exciting. I mean, I think that was our most profound discovery. And we could see that the this plume and the geysers coming off Enceladus, actually, some of them, the plume extends for hundreds of kilometers, but some of these geysers were so collimated, we could follow them. We could follow the particles, the frost particles in them, because there's vapor and there's also tiny frost particles. The imaging experiment sees only this frost particles. We could follow them and see them in our pictures. They were tendrils that extended tens of thousands of kilometers from Enceladus. And that right there showed us this is what was supplying the E-ring. This was the cause of the ring that was discovered back in the 1960s. It was the geysering activity coming off Enceladus. And so all this together points to Enceladus, really raised Enceladus to be the best target to visit if you want to address the question, has life arisen? It's got, and right now is the body we understand the most. We have the most evidence indicating this. And I'm, you know, been eager since 2006, maybe 2005, to see a mission go back to investigate whether or not life is there, whether or not there are microbes, you know, coming out of the geysers.
And I imagine through the lens of science, our ability to measure certain, you know, different things would have improved vastly since that time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The instruments on Cassini were designed in the early 1990s.
Yeah.
I mean, think how far we've come. Yeah, they're vastly improved. So really would love to go back. A landed mission, a mission that gets on the surface, would be absolutely the best. We could collect a lot of material if we're on the surface. There's no limit, you know, just the duration that we, you know, how long we allow the mission to go on. That would allow us to measure to really good precision and search for biosignatures, and we could really come back with a high degree of confidence, no matter what the result, whether there's nothing there or we do find something. So it really is the way to investigate Enceladus, and I just hope it happens.
Mm. So, Carolyn, I definitely want to dig into the idea of sustaining human life or finding life on these planets. But let's shift gear a little bit before diving in. I was watching your 2020 TED Talk titled There Is No Planet B, and I felt that over the course of your career and in doing my research, that there was a shift in your energy with regards to your work. Now, of course, you were still deeply passionate about space, but in this presentation, you were also equally concerned about life on Earth. You spoke with deep emotion about humankind landing on the moon when you were young and that being a really significant memory for you, but you also spoke about a flawed economic model that is really chewing through Earth's resources, the lack of systems engineering in human progression, and the very scary thought that our need to commercialize the world was leading to a need to commercialize space. You mentioned entrepreneurs such as Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Their message, we can only save ourselves if we leave the Earth. What concerns you the most about this perspective?
What concerns me is that it is hyperbole, it's overreach, and it's basically marketing for their brand and their vision.
Mm.
And they have, you know, reached the tallest peaks in their accumulation of wealth and power and their dominance, really, of human activities. And not surprisingly, they want even more. That's just human nature. It could be, I think, any one of us. Mm. That's what power and wealth do to us, you know? And so they've attained that level. And now they want to, you know, project their brand and so on into space. It's like the loftiest thing we could do. And that entails exploiting access to space for profits. And they're not alone. Other companies are clamoring for their share of the pie. And there is very little, if any, regulation of these activities. And I see in all this, and I'm not alone in this, I see in all this the very same forces that have been so ruinous to our planet down here, over-exploitation, unregulated, unchecked exploitation, about to be enacted all over again above our heads, and I just think it's dangerous.
Mm.
I firmly believe that we undertake space travel to learn about the nature of the cosmos, to create knowledge, new knowledge, and And that space travel should be motivated by scientific exploration, not exploitation by commercial interests.
So, Carolyn, we know that at this point in time, Earth is the only planet with life. Yet at the same time, there are people, those same entrepreneurs we just referenced, openly talking about the idea that the future of humanity will be interplanetary. Do you think, based on your study, your research, that it is possible for, say, a Saturn moon or Mars as two examples to sustain human life? And this is a slight double-barreled question, because even if we could, should we?
Well, I mean, Enceladus, it's sustaining human life, absolutely not. There's nothing there that, you know, when you say sustain, okay, we have to define our terms here. When you say sustain, I interpret that as meaning, could humans colonize a place? And that means live there, be multi-generation, actually live out their lives. So you're asking me, will future humans ever have an address on Enceladus or an address on Mars? Okay, Enceladus is out of the question. There's no atmosphere. We are evolved to live on a surface, not in an ocean. And that's all really Enceladus offers. That's not going to happen. There is, of course, as I just said, the potential for Enceladus to sustain microbial life, but not human life. On Mars, I could see with an enormous expensive effort establishing outposts there of the kind that we have on Antarctica, research stations that are continuously inhabited, but not by the same people. That's not their home. That's not their address. They're not going to get married there. They're not going to raise the next generation there. Elon Musk has talked about terraforming Mars. I mind you, that means jump-starting the habitability of an entire alien barren planet. That's what he talks about doing. We know now that is out of the question. And multi-generational colonies living there on a terraformed Mars is just a fantasy, just not possible. We know this from recent results, even older results, together with recent results from Mars orbiting spacecraft, that there's just not enough CO2 to create a substantial enough greenhouse effect to raise the temperature and so on. And then, of course, we have to manufacture oxygen. There's radiation issues to deal with. It just, you're not going to make it a body as perfectly made for us and we for it as the Earth. So I think that's a fantasy. And should we do this? Is it wiser to deal with healing this planet we already live on? To me, the answer is absolutely clear. Let's re-terraform, let's use that energy that these guys have, their resources, and re-terraform our own planet. Reverse the worst of the destruction we have brought to it and learn how to live here sustainably in harmony with other creatures within a healthy and prosperous biosphere. That will entail a lot. It will not only entail the technology of actually removing CO2 from the atmosphere, because that's what we need to do, not just bring emissions down to zero. That will not be enough. We have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. That is not an easy task. I think it is our moral duty to clean up the oceans. Oceans are filled with our garbage, with our trash, with our plastics, and it is killing sea life. The way we just wantonly access the ocean, we have these massive tanker ships that transport our goods. You know, this is the result of free trade. There's constant traffic across the oceans. There are animals living in the oceans just can't survive with that kind of activity. It would take a lot of altering of human culture. I'm a big one for the fact that we have to cease eating meat. You know, the raising of cattle is surprisingly, but it's a major contributor to the destruction of our environment, not only methane injection into the atmosphere, but the amount of land it requires to raise cattle and so on. We have just been incredibly exploitive, and it's going to take a lot, but I think we need to do it. I think it just has to be done.
Yeah, and I mean, it's for me such a privilege to interview you, because I think you have had such a unique perspective of the planet, and have in your work, been a part of creating images that really enable us to reflect on our humanity and our connection to our home, and how important that is, and the idea that there is no planet B. This actually matters the most.
This one matters the most.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Carolyn, in 2013, you created an image and event named The Day the Earth Smiled, where you invited people all over the world to celebrate humanity's place on Earth by smiling when the picture was taken. Now, I imagine this was an extremely meaningful project where you were able to help the world see the Earth from your perspective, as we've just discussed, to locate ourselves as a part of a vast and interconnected universe, and to acknowledge the Earth as our home. Over the course of your career, you have viewed the universe through perspectives many of us couldn't even imagine, yet your purpose today seems to be focused on reconnecting us to this planet and to the creation of a better world. So talk to me about why this mission today matters the most to you.
It matters because unless we feel a deep connection to our own planet, to our home, unless we understand, I mean, really at a very deep level, like in the gut, I guess unless we, are scared enough to realize how imperiled we are, and other creatures, unless we understand how imperiled we and other living creatures are because of our own misguided actions, we won't feel moved to take the necessary actions to protect it. I think we all really have ready within us a need and a desire to feel connected to the world around us. I think this is why, psychologists say that people need to get out into green spaces. We need to populate cities with more greenery, with more parks. They talk about forest bathing. The psychological calming effect it has to just be walking in a forest. Finally, we're coming to realize this thing about packing everybody into cities and it's not what we're made for. We are meant to feel connected. We are meant to be out in nature. And I think all we have to do is encourage people to go in that direction, and it will happen. They'll feel a connection. And hopefully that will be the first step to getting everybody on board, to realizing we better take the necessary actions to protect our planet.
Absolutely. And it's interesting hearing you talk about that, because it reminds me a lot of, our Indigenous people here in Australia, but I imagine also in the States, and they have such a profound and deep connection to Earth. They are located by the Earth, and it kind of loops back into exactly what you're talking about here, that we are nature. So therefore, of course, we need to be a part of that nature to feel connected, and from there to care for these things, to not put plastic in the ocean or to, destroy our natural environments.
It's so interesting to hear you say that about your native people, because I think about what a gigantic mistake it was, and how horrible it was what we did in America to Native Americans. And nowadays, biologists and people who are conservationists and studying the environment and wanting to know what's the best way to be a good steward of the earth, they are in fact turning to Native Americans for ancient Native American knowledge to understand how they approached stewardship of the planet. And their practices were so wise. And it started, their practices started from a deep respect that they had for the earth. They even had deep respect. I don't know if all the tribes did, but you know, there certainly were some that had deep respect even when they killed an animal to feast on it. You know, they would, they just did it with respect. And I mean, contrast that with industrialized meat production.
Oh, it's just, you can't even compare the two. You're talking about a sacred respect for an animal that is a part of nature and life versus murder, really.
Murder, torture. Oh, my God, the horrific treatment. So, I think the move, I mean, it's good. It's one of those things that gives me hope that, you know, people really dedicating themselves to trying to reverse our damage are looking to the Native Americans. And in your case, I guess.
They are definitely looking to the Indigenous people now. Yeah.
For guidelines, like, hey, why don't you teach us what you knew? So that's a good thing.
Yeah. So I have come to my last question today. And as someone who has captured, you know, so many images from space and then shared some of those images with the world, you are not only a pioneering scientist, but a visual storyteller. A storyteller and a science communicator with the ability to help us shift our perspectives in the most wondrous of ways. With that in mind, at this particular point in human history, what story do you think needs to be told and needs to be heard in order to create a more peaceful and a more abundant future for the people and the planet? What story matters to you the most?
Well, I have come to feel that the story of our existence and how we came to be is one with tremendous power to realign our priorities. Evolutionary biologists, in fact, tell us that we who have been given life have won the lottery, that the chances that any one of us being alive are infinitesimally small. So to say that life is a gift is not just a metaphor, it's true. And what's more, just in simply being alive, we and every other living organism on Earth are the embodiment of life. And that is the most complex, finely tuned, adaptive, high fidelity, self-regulating, self-propagating process in the universe. And every organism on our planet has, over time, evolved to be as perfectly adapted to its planetary ecological niche as we are to ours. We, all of us, all creatures, are masters at the task of evolution and existence. And all life forms on our world are members of the same tribe. We're all earthlings, all different elements of one large, intricate, delicately balanced, interconnected web of life that has developed here on this planet and on which all of us are completely and absolutely dependent. We are part of it, it is part of us, and if that web fails, we are going to fail too. And that is the significance of existence, when you think about it, that we exist at all, and together, all of us together, including all the other creatures and life forms on the planet, we just simply being alive is significant. And in simply being alive, we are the improbable manifestation of the most profound creation this magnificent universe has to offer. That is the story that matters most to me. So I think if we could find a way to hold that thought, you know, and maybe from time to time on a dark night, go out and gaze up at the Milky Way to actually see our home in the cosmos and recognize it for what it really is, maybe that just would provide the perspective that we need to regard each other on this island jewel in space with the respect and compassion that we all deserve. And once that's in place, I think we could create a prosperous future for us because we would care. Mm. We would care enough to do so.
Carolyn, I have to say, I am truly honored to have had you on the podcast today and in essence to be a part of your legacy to the world, your words, your ideas, your brilliant perspectives, everything that you have given the earth, given the young scientists out there who are young female scientists, especially who are following in your footpath. And for me to be a part of that in this podcast in sharing your ideas, I'm just so deeply humbled. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me. And it's really been a pleasure. I do want to talk about this. I want to get it out there. I just hope we're going to be able to pull it all together.
Well, through your work, you're definitely creating the golden thread to make that possible. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like updates on upcoming episodes as they are released, in addition to good news posts from the world of science and technology, please follow along at our Instagram page, which is at DNA of Purpose Podcast, or sign up to our newsletter at futurecrunch.com. You can also download our brand new ebook on the Great Transformation, which is available at our website. And these links are also included in the show notes. You can think of the Great Transformation document as your field guide to the next economy.